Welcome to Double X Science. It's in your genes. Today is Friday, April 5th, 2013. I am Adrienne Rorick, chemistry editor, and with me today is Jeannie Garbarino, biology editor at Double X Science. Good morning, Jeannie.
Morning, Adrienne. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Today, I wanted to talk about why did we go into science? So tell me, why did you go into science? What's your origin story?
I wish I had something kind of exciting to tell you, you know, some epiphany that brought me into science. I feel like I can just call myself a purebred. I was one of those kids that just wanted to ask questions and do experiments and explore just because I found it really interesting. And so I was always drawn to it. Even as a kid, I had a chemistry set. I would constantly read encyclopedias on plants. I really love plants, plant like biodiversity and plant taxonomy. I actually, at one point in time, could tell you a variety of trees in the Northeast by their Latin names. The only one I can remember is Acer saccharum, which is a sugar maple, but I've forgotten everything. Yeah, so it was something that I was really interested in. I didn't actually have a lot of guidance growing up. I'm the first person in my family to actually have graduated from college, so getting a PhD was like overachieving a little bit relative to the gangs. Not to sound all mushy or cliche, I kind of just went with my heart because I really loved my biology classes, my ecology classes. And then when I found genetics, I was just like, whoa, this is amazing. I love genetics, and I love biochemistry. When I was in school and I would take the tests, I would just ace them, much to the chagrin of my classmates who were depending on the curve. I actually got some notes that weren't very kind asking me to not get 100s on tests, which was,
Yeah,
so I kind of became a little isolated because I didn't want anybody to know that I could do it because I didn't want to get in trouble. Yeah, and so that just basically brought me into grad school where I did a PhD in sort of genetics and biochemistry, and that brought me into a postdoc where I continued doing genetics and biochemistry. And along that way, I just started becoming more and more interested in genetics and biochemistry, but more in sort of broad terms and not very specific, and outreach and education. And because I had so many wonderful, influential teachers along the way, I just wanted to give back and do more to get kids involved in science, especially those kids that didn't necessarily have the guidance. Like, I didn't have the guidance. My parents, they did whatever they could. They did the best they could under the circumstances.
Right.
But they didn't, you know, they didn't really know that I should be getting experience in this thing versus that thing, or reading that book instead of going out and playing stickball outside in the courtyard of my building or something. I want to be able to tell them, you can do this, and here I'm a living, breathing proof that it can happen for you. So,
yeah, I was actually going to ask you what your influences are. If you had really good teachers that helped you, since your parents weren't necessarily able to guide you just due to their lack of experience in it.
Yeah, there is one teacher that really was incredibly influential to me. His name was Mr. Monero, and he was my 10th grade biology honors teacher. He taught us as a person who was paralyzed from the neck down. So basically, he was a very active teacher. He would take all the students on skiing trips, and they played tennis all the time, and he was just constantly on the move. And then one day, he was taking his car in for an oil change, and he figured, why sit there? I'll go for a run. And he ended up getting hit by a car, and it paralyzed him from the neck down. And so even though this was so tragic for him, he still came in, and his passion was so incredible. His passion for teaching biology and the types of obstacles that he had to overcome to be in that classroom every day was so inspiring to me that I was thinking, you know what, I cannot complain about anything, and I need to just work my butt off because I need to make this person proud that his efforts, which are so incredible, are going to be shining through, you know, his students, and I want to be one of those students.
Wonderful.
About 10 years later, one of my sisters is 10 years younger than me, and so when I went to her high school graduation, I ran into him, and I was in my PhD program, and I told him that I was I was pursuing a PhD, and he started crying, and he was like, we got one, I can't believe it, we got one. And I still talk to him on Facebook, and, you know, I just... I've done a lot of what I've done because I thought about him and how he made things happen. And it was a really incredible thing for me.
Yeah, I think the support can make all the difference. So it's really wonderful that you are trying to now be that support for other students.
Yeah.
In that age range.
Absolutely. Why did you get into science, Adrian?
Well, I have a kind of a funny story about that. And I had an epiphany. I do have a very strong academic turn in my family. My grandmother, who just turned 100, and her sister, my great aunt, they both got nursing degrees, and my grandmother also taught, so she did the nursing thing for a while and then got a teaching degree and taught for so many years that her students that she taught sixth grade to 40, 50 years ago came to her 100th birthday party. So it's a pretty strong thing. And my parents both have advanced degrees. My dad's got a biology bachelor's and an economics master's, and my mother is a lawyer, so the third JD. And my family all encouraged my sister and I to pursue whatever we're interested in, that we could achieve really high things. When I was in seventh grade, you get kind of an overview of all the sciences, right? And so we did the worm dissection for biology, and I just kind of was grossed out about that. But then we got to the chemistry section, and we were introduced to the periodic table of elements. And my mom tells a story that I went home that day and said, I just love the periodic table of elements. This thing just rings true to me. It resonates. And I love the organization, and I love thinking about what that means. She, being a lawyer, she never saw her strength as science and math, so she kind of was like, who is this kid? But she wholeheartedly supported me, and so I knew from then on I wanted to do chemistry. And I had a really good seventh grade teacher, Mr. Gilman, and he supported me once I was like, yeah, this is cool. He was really wonderful about that. And then I went into high school and made sure I took all the chemistry classes I could take. Even though I wasn't super interested in biology, the biology teacher, Mr. Carey, really supported my science interest, which is great. And Mr. Derrig was my chemistry teacher, and he got me into a couple programs. And that's also helpful because my parents didn't know these things either, even though they had some of the support. And he got me into academic decathlon and a special science program, too, that went along with that. And so we had some one-on-one chats. It was really nice. And also, there was a chemistry laboratory, like an industry laboratory, and I got to do that for a while. So I got to work with somebody, so that was fun. And that's why I think your program's so cool, because I have a feeling it's kind of similar, and it really does help. In some ways, it kind of was like, I don't know if I want to do that, but at least it showed me, at least one career path, and I knew it wasn't the only one. That's what I did. And then, yeah, I pursued chemistry in undergraduate and then went on for chemistry in graduate school. And again, that I ended up in a group that did nuclear magnetic resonance, NMR. And I'd always thought it was interesting, but being able to delve into it really is what inspired my interest and why I've decided to make sure I can continue doing NMR. Now on to our week of posts. This week we had 6 posts. The first post went up on April 1st, and this was not an April Fool's joke. Our editor-in-chief, Emily Willingham, gave us an obituary fail of the Finkbeiner test on Monday, and it would have been better if that obituary had been an April Fool's, because the obituary in reference, it was an obituary that appeared in the New York Times about a famous scientist that had more to do with her cooking skills and mothering than to do with her science. Emily writes about the Finkbeiner test a little bit here, which has become quite a sensation, and it was written about by Christy Ashwanden at Double X Science on March 5th. And if you just Google Finkbeiner test, you can find a Wikipedia page, you can find our original post. So I do recommend you go back and read that. But back to this obituary, it was about Yvonne Brill, who's best known for developing the propulsion system that keeps satellites in orbit where they belong. So that's a really important science discovery and technology. And so the post has a little bit of a satire of the New York Times obituary and then goes on to explain exactly what Yvonne Brill did and then where the obituary went wrong. Many people were outraged by this obituary, and you actually can find many posts throughout the internet about where this obituary went wrong. So go ahead and take a look at that at the Double X Science website.
So on Monday, April 1st, we had another post on Double X Science, so we doubled up for April Fool's Day. And our post on Monday was from our DXS contributor, Jenny Morber, and it was called The Average Human Vagina. And this was quite a sensation as well, because it basically talked about what an average human vagina should look like. So it included both vaginas and the vulva, and it basically said that vaginas and vulvas are so diverse that you can't even quantify what normal should look like, and normal doesn't exist. I really thought that this was an extremely important post because, honestly, people don't really know. You can look at someone's face, you can look at someone's hands, and you're like, oh, my hands kind of look like that, or my face, oh, we have similar features, but nobody's looking at other people's genitalia, right? So how do you know what?
Or not in mass, at least.
Yeah, right. So perhaps with your partner or partners, you know, you've seen some small sampling, assuming.
But not.
Yeah, right? So how do you know what the giant overall average is? And it was really nice to hear that it doesn't matter because there is no normal. We have a really skewed perception of what a vagina or vulva should look like because of the porn industry.
Okay.
Yeah, and so basically the women who participate in the porn industry are typically kind of selected because they kind of have a prepubescent look to them, and I think it skews your idea of what a beautiful or normal looking vagina should look like, when that in fact is not necessarily representative of the female population.
Great. It sounds very interesting, and it is safe for work, so you can go ahead and take a look at it. There is an MRI image and a kind of a funny image about a doctor, I don't know exactly if he would be have been considered an OBGYN, examining a woman where he's lifted her skirts, and he clearly isn't looking at it, so how does he know what's going on?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, and just to clarify, it's from like the 19th century.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. It's a 19th century picture. So it is, this article is definitely safe for work, and go ahead and take a look at that.
That kind of grosses me out, I have to say, because I'm just thinking about how they didn't have latex gloves or any kind of like sterile material, and he's just like going up in there, you know?
Right. Well, and they didn't know at that time, I think, necessarily to wash their hands.
Exactly.
Between exams and stuff. And even that took a long time to catch on. It does make having had an exam.
Thank goodness for knowing about microbiology and disease transmission in your female gynecological exams. So.
Yes, definitely. All right. And then Tuesday, our own biology editor who's with us today, Jeannie Garbarino, told us about Evidence-Based Parenting Carnival, which is a new community resource to help us not mess up. So, Jeannie, could you tell me about how you were introduced to this evidence-based parenting and how you decided to come up with these lists of good blogs to visit to help us determine what the sort of research supporting parenting is about?
Sure. So it's actually not my idea. This was something that was brought to my attention by Alice Callahan, who is the owner and sole writer at a site called Science of Mom. And Alice writes a lot about evidence-based parenting. What's the peer-reviewed research about sleep training? What's the peer-reviewed research about breastfeeding versus formula feeding? And so really useful, really relevant information that we need in a parenting community. And
I agree.
Yeah, so I mean, instead of saying, oh, well, my friend puts cereal in the bottles, you should do that if your baby's crying. I mean, well, what's the evidence for that? Why should I do that? And I think it's important that we try to teach parents, especially new parents, to question why people tell them to do the things that they do and understand if this is the right thing based on the evidence and the research about this thing.
Right, because, for instance, I know you used to treat crying babies with a finger of whiskey to their gums, right, if they had teething, right?
Right?
And everyone laughs that off now, but that was a common thing that was, you know, not too many decades ago.
I'm not sure everyone's laughing it off. I'm pretty sure my friend's grandmother told me to do that to my kids. So, but.
Well, right. Like, yeah, but that, like you laughed that off, right?
Yeah.
So,
yes, I did. In fact, I took the whiskey and I put it in my gums instead of my baby's.
It's probably a good resolution.
Yeah.
But yeah, so my point being that what we do for parenting changes over time. So having actual evidence of what's good and why it sounds good, that Science of Mom has an active Facebook page. So
yeah, definitely. And so I just want to point out though that the initial idea to create a community of evidence-based bloggers was Jennifer Dover Spike. Jennifer Dover Spike was actually the person who initiated this movement, and she did so through conversations with Alice Callahan. And Jennifer Dover Spike is the owner of 649, which is a blog that talk about childhood learning and the impact of social media on today's parents. She also touches on infant sleep and basically evidence-based science to support any kind of parenting claims. And so when she and Alice talked about it, they decided that they wanted to bring together all the bloggers that do talk about evidence-based parenting, and that's basically how it was born. And so the carnival was actually hosted over at Science of Mom, and we had a lot of great submissions, and we're going to do a monthly carnival. And I believe the next month, for May, we're going to talk about motherhood and what that means to you, and in particular, how you found motherhood to affect you when you first started experiencing it. What type of bonds did you create or not create? You know, what is normal, or at least what is your experience? And so I think this is good for the community at large, especially people who they may not have a sense of community or a feeling of community in their own area. And just knowing what other people are going through is I think, really a really valuable and powerful tool.
So this is a new consortium, and so these initial blogs, so this post looks like it's a summary of several of the blogs that will be included in this group.
Yes,
right?
Yeah. And the hope is that we'll find more people that are doing this and then create a consortium that would basically point someone in the direction of any topic that has, well, someone might come up with. We hope that it's somehow covered in this consortium.
Wonderful. And, you know, it looks like a wide range of people with a wide range of specialties and interests. And so it does seem like most topics of parenting would be somewhere covered in these blogs.
Yeah, absolutely. So on Wednesday, our editor-in-chief, Emily Willingham, gave us a lesson on what is a beating embryonic heart. And this was in light of the North Dakota law that made abortions illegal if a heartbeat is detectable. And Emily brought this up because she wanted to point out the similarities of a beating heart among our evolutionary predecessors. So basically, you cannot tell the difference between the embryonic heart, at least in the early stages, of a human versus a frog versus a lizard or turtle, chicken, mouse. There's no way to differentiate it, and she just wanted to point this out as an argument because we feel very strongly that women should have a right to choose. And if you're going to cherry pick the science, you should probably do so in a way that's a little bit more informed and a little bit more educated. And I think Emily did a great job describing what exactly a beating heart is, why this is kind of not the most valid criterion for determining when life starts.
On Thursday, we learned that a robotic hysterectomy is more expensive, and we're asked, is it better? And this was posted by DXS contributor Jen Gunter, who has posted with us before. So this is about sort of the methods of a hysterectomy, of which there are four common ones, and what the pros and cons of specifically the robotic hysterectomy is. This is, of course, some people think, oh, we're progressing and advancing our technology, but it turns out that probably a robotic hysterectomy, the higher price does not mean a better product. In a very short summary, is a robotic hysterectomy better? in a word, no, unless you have cancer. So there is this one caveat. And she goes through a study that was published in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, about why there was this increase and why gynecologists are pushing these robotic hysterectomies, and then what the American Congress of OBGYNs, which is also known as ACOG, what they recommend in terms of a robotic hysterectomy, and the fact that this robot adds, on average, $2,000 to a hysterectomy. This adds money to the healthcare system, and so what this robotic hysterectomy may be doing is an overall increasing healthcare costs, which are, of course, being increased for any number of reasons. This is a really great post, and there was a video, albeit promotional video, that we added to the post to help people understand the procedure. So another great post by Jen Gunter posted at XX Science.
On Friday, we co-opted our usual I Am Mental Illness series post in order to cover some breaking news, in which Plan B is now available to younger teens. In December 2011, Kathleen Sebelius, the Obama administration's Health and Human Services Secretary, made a bid to block Plan B from those under 17. A federal judge has overturned that. Our editor-in-chief, Emily Willingham, wrote a post discussing what the Plan B is, what pregnancy for the age group under 17 means in terms of health and economic and socio status.
And you can find all those posts at our website, xxscience.org, by clicking on the links to the posts on the main page. In addition to our XXScience site postings, our sister site, XXScience Jr., had two posts this week. Tuesday was about mistakes leading to cool science, technology, and inventions that we use every day. And Thursday was about the advertisement Science World in Vancouver, BC, Canada has posted. Both were by Future Science Leaders bloggers, which we have that collaboration with. These were just kind of more fun posts this week. These were not quite the hardcore science. Every once in a while we get lovely hardcore science and,
right,
and studies that have been looked at by these students, but they are high school students, so you get some things that are fun. And I had a really good time looking actually at the Science World ads, because they have these little factoids and they're done in a very visual manner. So this was kind of fun to look at.
Yeah, that's always good for kids, especially if they're like me, where I'm a visual learner. I like to see things in front of me so that I can have this sort of visual representation of what it is I should be learning. So kudos to Science World for figuring that out.
Yeah, I have to say, I think my favorite one is the one of Jason with the mask, the holes. Do you know which character?
Oh my gosh, yes. I am quite familiar with Jason. It was probably the subject of my nightmares as a child.
Yeah. And it says, you see better when you're scared, with it written in almost one of those eye charts. So that's my favorite. So, but these are really great. So, you know, go check that one out, definitely.
To be honest with you, I kind of like the shark one, which is a couple down from the Jason one, where they have a shark that had been, I guess, caught, which is kind of makes me sad at the same time. But right, when they emptied the contents of the shark's belly, what they found was a phonograph. And that basically makes the point that sharks can live to be 100 years old. I don't think people fully appreciate how old these amazing animals can live to.
You can find these posts at xxsciencejr.blogspot.com or by following the link to XXScienceJr. from the xxscience.org main page. Now on to our news. Jeannie, what science news have you been reading this week?
I am involved in a project that is trying to take real-life images of the human brain and create a planetarium show about it. And
interesting.
Yeah, so even though I'm not formally trained as a neuroscientist, this project I thought was really compelling and it really sparked my interest, so I've been paying attention. It's kind of hard not to be paying attention to all of this neuroscience and brain initiative things that are coming out of Washington, D.C. So President Obama is pledging a significant amount of funds to brain research. I have a healthy skepticism about the actual projects themselves, only because I'm wondering, in this dire economic situation that we have, especially with our sequester and the money that is being cut from the NIH budget, how is this money going to be funneled into these neuroscience projects without affecting other types of science going on? I'm just interested in where this money is coming from and how it's going to affect non-neuroscience research. I've been really keen on following these things because of the NeuroDome project that I'm working on, which is this planetarium show about the brain. And we've actually launched a Kickstarter to help start things off. That's certainly not the end all. We're going to have to take this beyond our Kickstarter, but we're hoping that we can raise enough money to make a couple of animations that would allow us to give a proof of principle. And the ultimate goal is to have this planetarium show open up the horizons for people to think beyond space when we're talking about human exploration. We hope that it will spark interest in science and another kind of informal science education type of venue.
Okay.
Adrian, what science news have you been reading this week?
I tend to attract to random sets of science news. This week, the one that caught my eye was a study that was presented at the American Psychosomatic Society conference in Miami, which showed that basically unhealthy eating worsens mood if you're already in a bad mood. And this study was done by some Penn State researchers, and their results were presented on March 15th. Their summary was that negative mood was worse after disordered eating, so i.e. binge eating, which a lot of people call comfort eating. Mm-hmm. But a positive mood did not change either before or after any of the behavior studied by the researchers. Now, I couldn't find an actual publication, so this was probably findings that the findings were presented at this meeting, and so the publication's probably forthcoming. You can Google unhealthy eating worsens mood or a similar phrase, and you'll pull up several articles looking at this study. There are some issues with the study. It was done on 131 women, which is relatively small. It's a self-reported study, and we're college women, so we have a lot of issues there. But I think this can be helpful. This was actually supported in part by the National Institutes of Mental Health. And so I think it plays into disordered eating and possibly some other issues like depression and other mental health diagnoses, and how things like food play into those as well, which may help with treatments, you know, would be what I would hope. This is, of course, my own speculation, that you could then, when you treat any of these things, discuss that. But that kind of intrigued me. So maybe just knowing that, having that bag of chips, which tend to do myself, is that actually going to make me feel better? And I know this, right? After I've had that bag of chips, I don't usually feel better. I feel worse because now I've eaten a bag of chips. It hasn't done anything but maybe bring my blood sugar levels up, which was maybe not the best way to do that either. So that one was pretty interesting to me.
It's an important conversation. Eating disorders are very, very widespread. It's more prevalent than we even think, because there's a lot of people who won't talk about them. You know, anything that could help figure out what the mindset is, either whether it's psychological or whether they're looking at biological types of things, I think we need to understand as much as we can and try to help these usually young people, although eating disorder knows no age, but I often see a younger generation having that, and whatever we can do to help figure out how to help them is fine by me.
Right. That wraps up our week at XX Science.
Next week, we can expect a post about that microscopy from our tech editor, Jeff Perkel, that he discussed in last week's podcast, and we have a couple of great posts from contributors. We will have our I Am Mental Illness series. We'll have a post on pacifiers and breastfeeding. We'll have a post about STEM from our education editor, Chris Gunter. And we will have a post about chemistry terms.
Also look for next week an interview with Chris by me about that STEM post. And the 18th century chem terms I, of course, found interesting, so we'll talk about that next week, too.
Looking forward to it.
Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to our podcast via iTunes or your favorite podcatcher. If you're enjoying the podcast, please leave a review or a 5-star rating at iTunes to help bring science to more people. Our music is provided by Editor-in-Chief Emily Willingham. Our artwork is by Dallas Lopez. Please like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at XXI. This has been Chemistry Editor Adrian Rorick and Biology Editor Jeannie Garbarino. We are XX Science, bringing science to the woman in you.